same house unless there was a town somewhere near. Being alone on the prairie for so many weeks had made him realize how much he liked being in towns. Though when he thought about all that he had been through, he didn't feel he had much hope finding Ellie there. How could a woman come across such distances? As he approached the house, an old man appeared to the north, riding out of the Platte, his horse dripping water. July saw there were more horses north of the river. The old man had white hair and seemed to be a Mexican. He rode with a rifle held lightly across his saddle. July didn't want to appear unfriendly. He stopped to wait. The old man looked mainly at his leg. July had forgotten how ugly it looked. He had even forgotten it was still yellowish and almost bare, for he had cut his pants leg off when the leg was so swollen. "Is it bad?" the old man asked in English. July was glad for the English. "Not as bad as it was," July said. "Is Ogallala near here?"
20 miles, the old man said. "I'm Cholo. Come to the house. You must be hungry."
July didn't argue. He had almost forgotten that people sat at tables in houses to eat. He had lived so long on half-cooked bacon or half-cooked game that he had become shy at the thought of sitting at a proper table. He didn't look proper, he knew. As he approached the house, he suddenly heard shrieks of laughter, and a little girl flew around the corner of the house, another slightly older girl in hot pursuit. The girl in the lead ran onto one of the sheds between the house and the corral and tried to hide in it, but her sister caught her before she could get inside. And they tussled and shrieked. The older girl was trying to put something down the younger girl's neck, and she finally succeeded, at which point the younger girl began to hop up and down while the older one ran off laughing. As the two men rode up, a woman appeared on the back steps of the house. She wore a gray smock and an apron and had an infant in her arms. She was clearly out of temper, for she yelled something at the two girls, who stopped their shrieking, looked at one another, and slowly approached the house. The infant the woman held was crying fretfully, though at that making less noise than the girls. The woman addressed herself to the older girl, who made some excuse, and the younger girl, in her own defense, pointed back toward the shed. The woman listened a minute and began to talk rapidly, giving her daughters what for, July supposed. To see a woman so suddenly, after so much time alone, made him very nervous, particularly since the woman was so out of temper. But as they drew closer, he found that, out of temper or not, he couldn't stop looking at her. Her eyes flashed as she lectured her daughters, neither of whom was taking the lecture silently. Both were trying to talk back, but the mother didn't pause to listen. She had abundant brown hair tucked into a bun at the back of her neck, though the bun had partly come loose. The old Mexican seemed not the least disturbed by the argument in progress. In fact, he seemed amused by it, and he rode up and got off his horse as if nothing were happening.
"But she put a grasshopper down my neck," the younger girl said. "I hate her."
"I don't care who hates who," the woman said. "I was up with this baby all night. You know how colicky he is. You don't have to scream right under my window. Looks like there'd be room on this prairie for you to scream without doing it under my window. All we got here is room."
"It was a grasshopper," the little girl insisted.
"Well, is it the first one you've ever seen?" the woman asked. "You'll have more to worry about than grasshoppers if you wake this baby again."
The woman was rather thin, but anger put color in her cheeks. The girls finally were subdued, and the woman looked up and saw him, lifting her chin with a bit of belligerence, as though she might have to tie into him, too. Then she saw his discolored leg, and her look changed. She had gray eyes, and she turned them on him with sudden gravity.
"Get down, senor," the old man said.
The girls looked around and became aware for the first time that a stranger had come. They instantly stopped fidgeting and stood like statues. The woman smiled. She seemed to have switched from anger to amusement.
"Hello, I'm Clara," she said. "Pardon the commotion.
We're allowed, Bunch. Get down, sir. You're welcome. July had not spoken in so long, except for the few words he had said to Cholo and his ravings to Roscoe Brown, that his voice came out cracked.
Thank you. I wouldn't want to trouble you, he said.
Clara laughed. You don't look strong enough to trouble nobody around here, she said. We grow our own troubles. It would be a novelty to have some we ain't already used to. These are my daughters, Sally and Betsy. July nodded to the girls and got off his horse. After a ride, his legs stiffened, and he had to hobble over to the porch. As the baby was still fretting, the woman rocked it in her arms as she watched July hobble. Snake bit him, Cholo observed. I guess I rolled into it at night, July said. I never even seen it. Just woke up with a yellow leg. Well, if you've lived this long, I expect you have nothing to fear, Clara said. We'll get some food in you. The way sick people have been turning up lately, I sometimes think we ought to go out of the horse business and open a hospital. Come on in the house. You girls set him a place. The old man helped him up the steps into the roomy kitchen. Clara was poking the fire in the cook stove, the baby still held in one arm. If you'd like a wash first, I'll have the girls draw some water, Clara said. I didn't get your name.
I'm July Johnson. I come from Arkansas.
Clara almost dropped the poker. The girls had told her the little scar-faced man had said the woman they were with was married to a sheriff named Johnson, from Arkansas. She hadn't given the story much credence. The woman didn't strike her as the marrying type. Besides, the little man had whispered something to the effect that the big buffalo hunter considered himself married to her. The girls thought it mighty exciting, having a woman in the house who was married to two men. And if that wasn't complicated enough, the woman herself claimed to be married to D. Boot, the gunfighter they had hung last week. Cholo had been in town when the hanging took place and reported that the hanging had gone smoothly. Clara looked more closely at the man standing in her kitchen. He was very thin and in a kind of daze, probably couldn't quite believe that he was still alive after such a journey. She had felt that way herself upon arriving in Ogallala after her trip over the plains with Bob, and she hadn't been snake-bit or had any particular adventures. But if he was married to the woman, the baby drooling at her bosom might be his. Clara felt a flash of annoyance, most of it with herself. She had already grown attached to the baby. She liked to lie in bed with him and watch him try to work his tiny hands. He would peer at her for long stretches, frowning as if trying to figure life out. But when Clara laughed at him and gave him her finger to hold, he would stop frowning and gurgle happily. Apart from the colic, he seemed to be a healthy baby. She knew the mother was probably still in Ogallala, and that she ought to take the child into town and see if the woman had had a change of heart and wanted her son, but she kept putting it off. It would be discouraging to have to give him up. She told herself that if the mother didn't want him bad enough to come and get him, then the mother was too foolish to have him. She reminded herself it was time she got out of the habit of babies. She wouldn't be likely to get any more, and she knew she ought to figure out another way to keep herself amused. But she did like babies. Few things were as likely to cheer her up. She had never seriously supposed the father would turn up, and yet only 3 weeks had passed and one had, standing in her kitchen, dirty, tired, and with a badly discolored leg. Clara poked the fire a time or two more, trying to adjust to the surprise. Then she turned and looked at July. "Mr. Johnson," she said, "are you looking for your wife by any chance?" July almost fell over from surprise. "Yes. Her name is Ellie. Elmira," he said. "How'd you ever know?" He began to tremble. Clara came over and took his arm and led him to a chair. The girls were standing in the doorway, watching every move.
I've been looking for Ellie all the way, July said. I didn't even know she'd come this way. She's not a large woman. I was afraid she might have died. Have you seen her?
Yes, Clara said.
She stopped here for the night about 3 weeks ago in the company of two buffalo hunters. To July, it seemed too much of a miracle that with the whole plains to cross, he and Ellie would strike the same house. The woman who was watching him intently seemed to read his mind.
We get lots of travelers, she said, as though he hadn't spoken.
Situating this place right here was one of the smartest things my husband ever did. Anyone coming along the Platte who might need a horse isn't going to miss us. We're on the only road. If we hadn't located on this road, we'd have been starved out long ago.
It seems, July said, and he couldn't finish. It was all he had hoped for, to be able to find her someday. He had risked and lost three lives to do it, and though Ellie wasn't right there, surely she was in town. He began to tremble and then to cry. He couldn't help it. His hopes were to be answered after all. Silently, Clara handed him a rough dish towel. She scowled fiercely at the girls until they backed off. She followed them out the back door to give the man a moment to collect himself.
Why is he crying? Betsy asked.
He's just unnerved. He's come along a long way, and I imagine he had stopped expecting to make it, Clara said.
But he's a man, Sally said.
Their father had never cried, as far as she knew.
Men have tears in them, too, same as you, Clara said. Go draw some water. I think we might offer him a bath.
She went back in. July had not quite gained control of himself. He was too shaken with relief. The baby, now in a good mood, was mouthing its own fingers and rolling its eyes up to her. Might as well tell the man, she thought. She pulled out a chair and sat down at the table.
Mr. Johnson, I guess I've got another piece of news for you, Clara said. She looked from the baby's face to his, seeking resemblances. It seemed to her the foreheads were the same, and though the child had little hair, the little was the same color as July's. He was not a bad-looking man, just gaunt from his travels and dirty. She had a notion to make him shave when he had rested, so she could compare his face to the baby's. He could use Bob's razor. 1 week ago, she had stropped it and shaved Bob. July looked at her as she fiddled with the baby. The tears had left him feeling empty, but his gratitude to the woman for just being there and treating him kindly was so great that he felt he might cry again if he tried to speak. The woman seemed too beautiful and too kind to be true. It was clear she was older. She had fine wrinkles around her mouth, but her skin was still soft, and her face, as she wiggled the baby's little hand with one finger, was very beautiful. The thought of more news troubled him a little, though. Probably one of Elmira's companions had stolen something or made some mischief.
If that woman was your wife, I guess this is your child, Clara said.
She had it the night that she was here. Then she left. She was very anxious to get to town. I don't believe she realized what a fine boy she had. We all took to him right away around this place. July had not really looked at the baby. He had supposed it belonged to Clara. She had said her name was Clara. She was watching him closely with her kind gray eyes, but what she said seemed so unlikely that he couldn't really credit it. Elmira had said nothing to him about wanting a baby, or planning to have one, or anything. To him, so tired he could hardly sit straight, it just meant another mystery. Maybe it explained why Elmira ran away, though it didn't to him. As for the little boy, wiggling in Clara's lap, he didn't know what to think. The notion that he had a son was too big a notion. His mind wouldn't really approach it. The thought made him feel lost again, as he had felt out on the plains. Clara saw that he was past dealing with it for the moment.
I'm sorry, Mr. Johnson, she said, immediately getting up. I should be cooking instead of worrying you with things you're too tired to deal with. You eat and go rest. This boy will still be here. We can discuss it tomorrow. July didn't answer, but he felt he was remiss. Not only was Clara going to a lot of trouble to feed him, she was taking care of a baby that might be his. He tried to think of things he might do or say, but nothing came to mind. Clara went cheerfully about the cooking, holding the baby in her arms most of the time, but occasionally plunking him on the table for a minute if she needed both hands for the work. "Just catch him if he starts to roll," she said. "That's all I ask." She fed July beefsteak and potatoes and peas. July felt he would be too tired to eat, and yet at the smell of the food his appetite returned and he ate every bite. "I made Bob build me a windbreak," she said. "I watched my gardens blow away for 10 or 12 years and finally got tired of it." July looked at her questioningly. "Bob's my husband," she said. "He's injured. We don't hold out too much hope for him." She had strained and heated a little milk, and while July ate, she fed the baby, using a big nipple she had fixed over a fruit jar. "We use this nipple for the colts," she said. "Sometimes the mares don't have their milk at first. It's a good thing this boy's got a big mouth." The child was sucking greedily on the nipple, which was quite large, it seemed to July. "I've been calling him Martin," Clara said. "Since he's yours, you may want to change it. I think Martin is a nice name for a man. A man named Martin could be a judge, or maybe go into politics. My girls fancy the name, too." "I don't guess he's mine," July said. "Ellie never mentioned anything about it." Clara laughed. It surprised him. "Had you been married long?" she asked. "About 6 months," July said. "When she left." "Oh, well, you were newlyweds then," Clara said. "She might have been put out with you and decided not to tell you." "She had another boy, Joe," July said. "He went with me when I went after Jake Spoon. Only Joe got killed on the plains. Ellie don't know it yet." "Did you say Jake Spoon?" Clara said. "I know Jake. We courted once. I saw him in Ogallala about a year ago, but the woman he was with didn't like my looks, so we didn't talk much." "Why were you after Jake?" July could barely remember it all. It seemed to have happened so long ago. "Jake was gambling and a fight got started," he said. "Jake shot off a buffalo gun and the bullet went through the wall and killed my brother. I was out of town at the time. Peach, my sister-in-law, wanted me to go after Jake. I wish now I hadn't." "It sounds accidental to me," Clara said. "Though I know that's no consolation to your family. Jake was no killer." "Well, I didn't catch him anyway," July said. "Elmira ran off. Roscoe come and told me. Now Roscoe's dead, too. I don't guess it could be my baby." Clara was still studying the two faces, the little one and the gaunt, tired one. It interested her, what came across from parent to child. "When did your wife run off?" she asked. "Oh, it's been over 4 months. A long time." Clara chuckled. "Mr. Johnson, I don't think arithmetic's your strong suit. I think this is young Mr. Johnson you're looking at." I had that figured out even without the dates, but the dates jibe pretty well. July didn't know what to say. Clara seemed delighted with her conclusion, but he didn't feel anything at all. It was just a puzzle. "I guess I'm awful," Clara said. "Any kind of company affects me this way. I shouldn't be bothering you when you're so tired. The girls are drawing water. You have a bath. You can sleep in their room. It's a good bed. Later, when he had bathed and fallen into a sleep so deep that he didn't even turn over for several hours, Clara brought the baby in and peeked at July. He hadn't shaved, but at least he had washed. Cleaned of dirt, he looked very young, only a few years older than her oldest boy would have been had he lived. Then she went to look at Bob for a moment. An ugly ooze had been seeping onto his pillow. The stitches in his head had been removed, but underneath the wound seemed hot. It might be a new infection. Clara cleaned it as best she could, and she took the baby out on her little porch. "Well, Martin, your pa showed up," she said, grinning at the baby. "It's a good thing we got a house right on the road. I wonder what your pa will think of us when he gets his wits together." The baby waved a hand in the warm air. Down at the lots, the girls were watching Cholo work with a 2-year-old filly. Clara looked at the baby and offered it her finger. "We don't much care what your pa thinks of us, do we, Martin? We already know what we think of him."
Chapter 78.
Lorena was sitting in her tent when Gus returned. She had been sitting there, hoping he wasn't dead. It was an unreasoning fear she had, that Gus might die. He had only been gone 3 days, but it seemed longer to her. The cowboys didn't bother her, but she was uneasy anyway. Dish Bogat set up her tent at night and stayed close by, but it meant nothing to her. Gus was the only man she wanted to look after her. Then, before it was quite dark, she heard horses and looked out to see Gus riding toward her. She was so glad she wanted to run out to him, but Dish Bogat was nearby, trimming his horse's feet, so she kept still. "She's fine, Gus," Dish said when Gus dismounted. "I looked after her as best I could." "How much obliged," Augustus said. "She won't hardly even look at me," Dish said. He said it mildly, but he didn't feel it mildly. Lorena's indifference pained him more than anything he had ever experienced. "Did you catch the horse thieves?" he asked. "We did. But not before they murdered Wilbarger and 4 other people."
"Hang 'em?"
"Yes, hung 'em all, including Jake Spoon."
"Well, I swear," Dish said, shocked. "I didn't like the man, but I never figured him for a killer."
"He wasn't a killer," Augusta said. "Jake liked to joke and didn't like to work. I've got exactly the same failings. It's lucky I ain't been hung."
He pulled the saddle off his tired horse. The horse lay down and had a good roll, scratching its sweaty back.
"Howdy do, miss," Augusta said, opening the tent. "Give me a hug."
Lorena did. It made her blush that he just asked like that.
"If hugs are to be had for the asking, what about kisses?"
Lorena turned her face up. The feel of his whiskers made her want to cry, and she held him as tight as she could.
"Well, I wish we'd brought a bathtub on this trip. I'm so dirty it's like kissing a groundhog."
Later, he went to the chuck wagon and brought back some supper. They ate outside the tent. In the distance, the Irishman was singing. Gus told her about Jake, but Lorena felt little. Jake hadn't come to find her. For days she had hoped he would, but when he didn't, and her hope died, the memory of Jake died with it. When she listened to Gus talk about him, it was as if he were talking about a man she hadn't known. He had faded into all the other men who had come and gone. He had got a thorn in his hand, she remembered that, but she didn't remember much else. She didn't much care that he was dead. He wasn't a good man, like Gus. What scared her was all the death. Now that she had found Gus, it was very frightening to her to think that he might die. She didn't want to be without him. Yet that very night she dreamed that he had died and she couldn't find the body. When she came out of the dream and heard him breathing, she clung so tightly to him that he woke up. It was very hot, and her clinging made them sweaty.
"What scared you?" Augustus asked.
"I dreamed you died," Lorena said.
I'm sorry I woke you.
Augusta sat up. I don't fret. I need to go water the grass anyway.
He went out and made water and stood in the moonlight a while, cooling off. There was no breeze in the tent, so Lorena came out too.
It's a good thing this grass don't depend on me, Augusta said. There's a lot more of it than I can get watered.
They were on a plain of grass so huge that it was hard to imagine there was a world beyond it. The herd and themselves were like a dot surrounded by endless grass. Lorena had come to like the space. It was a relief after her years of being crowded in a little saloon. Gus was staring at the moon, scratching himself.
I keep thinking we'll see the mountains, he said. I grew up in the mountains, you know, Tennessee. I hear them Rockies are a lot higher than the Smokies. They say they have snow on top of them the year round, which you won't find in Tennessee.
He sat down in the grass.
Let's sit out. We can nap in the morning. It will scandalize Carl.
Why does he go off at night? Lorena asked.
He goes off to be by himself. Woodrow ain't a sociable man.
Lorena remembered her other worry, the woman in Nebraska. When will we get there, Gus? Nebraska, I mean.
I ain't sure, he said. Nebraska's north of the Republican River, which we ain't come to yet. Might take us 3 weeks yet.
Lorena felt a dread that she couldn't get rid of. She might lose him to the woman. A strange trembling started. It was beyond her control. Gus put his arms around her to make it stop.
Well, it's natural to worry, he said. This is a chancy life. What's the main thing that worries you?
I'm feared you'll die, Augustus chuckled.
Darn right I'll die. What else worries you?
I'm feared you'll marry that woman.
I doubt it. That woman had 2 or 3 chances to marry me already. She didn't take him. She's an independent type, like you used to be.
That was so, Lorena reflected. She had been quite independent, but now all she could think of was keeping Gus. She wasn't ashamed, though. He was worth keeping.
It's funny humans take to the daylight so, he said. Lots of animals would rather work at night.
Lorena wanted him to want her. She knew he did want her, but he had done nothing. She didn't care about it. But if she could be sure that he still wanted her, then the dread of losing him might go away. Let's go in, she whispered, hoping he'd know what she meant. He immediately turned to her with a grin.
My, my, he said. Times do change. I remember when I had to cheat at cards to get a poke. We don't have to go into that hot old tent. I'll drag the bedding out here.
Lorena didn't care that the cowboys might see, or who might see. Gus had become her only concern. The rest of the world could watch out. But Gus merely hugged her and gave her a kiss. Then he held her tight all night. And when the sun woke her, the herd was already gone. Did anybody see us? She asked.
Well, if they did, they're lucky, Augustus said. They won't get too many chances to see such beauties as us.
He laughed and got up to make the coffee.
Chapter 79.
Newt couldn't get Jake out of his mind, how he had smiled at the end and given him his horse. He rode the horse every third day and liked his gait so much that he soon became his favorite horse. Jake hadn't told him what the horse's name was, which worried Newt. A horse needed a name. Jake's hanging had happened so quickly that it was hard to remember. It was like a terrible dream, of the kind you can only remember parts of. He remembered the shock it had been to see Jake with his hands tied, sitting on his horse with a noose around his neck. He remembered how tired Jake looked, too tired even to care that he was going to be hung. Also, nobody talked much. There should have been some discussion, it seemed to Newt. Jake might have had a good excuse for being there, but nobody even asked him for it. Not only had no one talked at the hanging, no one had talked since, either. Captain Call kept well to himself, riding far from the herd all day and sleeping apart at night. Mr. Gus stayed back with Lorena, only showing up at meal times. Dietz was very quiet when he was around, and he wasn't around much. He spent his days scouting far ahead of the herd, which was traveling easily. The Texas Bull had assumed the lead position, passing Old Dog almost every day and only giving up the lead to go snort around the tails of whatever cows interested him. He had lost none of his belligerence. Dish, who rode the point, had come to hate him even more than Needle Nelson did. "I don't know why we don't cut him," Dish said. "It's only a matter of time before he kills one of us." "He kills me, he'll die with me," Needle said grimly. Of course, all the hands were curious about Jake. They asked endless questions. The fact that the farmers had been burned puzzled them. "Do you think that they was trying to make people think Indians did it?" Jasper asked. "No. Dan Suggs just did it because he felt like it," P.I. said. "What's more, he hung 'em after they were already dead. Shot 'em, hung 'em, then burned 'em." "He must have been a hard case, that Dan," Jasper said. "I seen him once. He had them little squint eyes. I'm glad he never squinted them at me, if that's the way he behaves to white men," Needle said. "What was Jake doing with an outfit like that?" "If you ask my opinion, that whore that Gus has got was Jake's downfall," Bert Borum volunteered. "You can keep your damn opinion to yourself, if that's what you think," Dish said. He was as touchy as ever where Lorena was concerned. "Just because you're in love with a whore don't mean I can't express my opinion," Bert countered. "You can express it, and I can knock your darn teeth down your throat for you," Dish said. "Lori didn't make Jake Spoon into no criminal." Bert had always considered that Dish had been awarded the top hand position unfairly, and he was not about to put up with such insolence from him. He took his gun belt off, and Dish did the same. They squared off, but didn't immediately proceed to fisticuffs. Each walked cautiously around the other, watching for an opening. Their cautiousness provoked much jocularity in the onlookers. "Look at them press around," Needle Nelson said. "I used to have a rooster I'd match against either one of them." "It'll be winter before they hit the first lick at this rate," Jasper said. Dish finally leaped at Bert, but instead of boxing, the two men grappled and were soon rolling on the ground, neither gaining much of an advantage. Call had seen the men square off, and he loped over. When he got there, they were rolling on the ground, both red in the face, but doing one another no harm. He rode the hell bitch right up to them, and when they saw him, they both stopped. He had it in his mind to dress them down, but the fact that the other hands were laughing at their ineffectual combat was probably all that was needed. Anyway, the men were natural rivals in ability and could be expected to puff up at some point. He turned and rode back out of camp without saying a word to them. When he saw him go, Newt's heart sank. The captain said less and less to him, or to anyone. Newt felt more and more of a need for somebody to talk about Jake. He had been the captain's friend, and Mr. Gus's. It didn't seem right that he could be killed and buried, and no more said. It was Dietz, finally, who understood and helped. Dietz was good at mending things, and one night, as he was mending Newt's bridle, Newt said what was on his mind. "I wish we could have at least taken him to jail," Newt said. "They'd hang him, too," Dietz said. "I expect he'd rather us did it." "I wish we hadn't even come," Newt said. "It's just too many people dying. I didn't think we'd ever kill Jake. It wasn't like an accident." "If he didn't kill anybody, then it wasn't fair," he added. "Well, there was those horses, too," Dietz said. "He only liked pacers," Newt said. "He wouldn't be bothered to steal horses as long as he had one to ride. Just being along didn't make him a horse thief." "It do to the captain," Dietz said. it do to Mr. Gus? They didn't even talk to him, Newt said bitterly. They just hung him. They didn't even act like they were sorry. They sorry, Dietz said. Saying won't change it. He's gone. Don't worry about him. He's gone to the peaceful place. He put his hand for a moment on Newt's shoulder. You need to rest your mind. Don't worry about the sleepers. How do you stop? Newt wondered. It wasn't a thing he could forget. P.I. mentioned it as he would mention the weather, something natural that just happened and was over. Only for Newt, it wasn't over. Every day it would rise in his mind and stay there until something distracted him. Newt didn't know it, but Call 2 lived almost constantly with the thought of Jake Spoon. He felt half sick from thinking about it. He couldn't concentrate on the work at hand, and often if spoken to, he wouldn't respond. He wanted somehow to move time backwards to a point where Jake could have been saved. Many times in his thoughts he managed to save Jake, usually by having made him stay with the herd. As the herd approached the Republican, Call's thoughts were back on the Brazos, where Jake had been allowed to go astray. At night, alone, he grew bitter at himself for indulging in such pointless thoughts. It was like the business with Maggie that Gus harped on so. His mind tried to change it, have it different, but those were two pointless thoughts. Things thought and things said didn't make much difference, and with Gus spending all his time with the woman, there was very little said anyway. Sometimes Gus would come over and ride with him for a few miles, but they didn't discuss Jake Spoon. As such things went, it had been simple. He could remember hangings that had been harder, once they had to hang a boy for something his father had made him do. When they sighted the Republican River, Gus was with him. From a distance, it didn't seem like much of a river. "That's the one that got to Pumphrey Boy, ain't it?" Augusta said. "Hope it don't get none of us. We're a skinny outfit as it is." "We wouldn't be if you did any work," Call said. "You going to leave her in Ogallala or what?" "Are you talking about Lori or this mare I'm riding? If it's Lori, it wouldn't kill you to use her name." "I don't see that it matters," Call said. Though even as he said it, he remembered that it had seemed to matter to Maggie. She had wanted to hear him say her name. "You've got a name," Augusta said. "Don't it matter to you whether people use it?" "Not much," Call said. "No, I guess it wouldn't," Augusta said. "You're so sure you're right, it doesn't matter to you whether people talk to you at all. I'm glad I've been wrong enough to keep in practice."
"Why would you want to keep in practice being wrong?" Call asked. "I'd think it would be something you'd try to avoid."
"You can't avoid it. You got to learn to handle it. If you only come face to face with your own mistakes once or twice in your life, it's bound to be extra painful. I face mine every day. That way they ain't usually much worse than a dry shave."
"Anyway, I hope you leave her," Call said. "We might get in the Indians before we get to Montana."
"I'll have to see," Augusta said. "We've grown attached. I won't leave her unless I'm sure she's in good hands."
"Are you aiming to marry?"
"I could do worse. I've done worse twice, in fact. However, matrimony's a big step, and we ain't discussed it."
"Of course you ain't seen the other one yet," Call said.
"That one's got a name, too. Clara. You are determined not to use names for females. I'm surprised you even named your mare."
"P.I. named her," Call said. It was true. P.I. had done it the first time she bit him. That afternoon, they swam the Republican without losing an animal. At supper, afterward, Jasper Flant's spirits were high. He had built up an unreasoning fear of the Republican River, and felt that once he crossed it, he could count on living practically forever. He felt so good, he even danced an impromptu jig.
"You've missed your calling, Jasper," Augusta said, highly amused by this display. "You ought to try dancing in whorehouses. you might pick up a favor or two that otherwise you couldn't afford.
You reckon the captain will let us go to town once we get to Nebraska? Needle asked.
Seems like a long time since there's been a town.
If he don't, I think I'll marry a heifer, Bert said.
Pocampo sat with his back against a wagon wheel, jingling his tambourine.
It's going to get dry, he said.
Fine, Soupy replied. I got wet enough down about the Red to last me forever.
It's better to be wet than dry, Pocampo said. Usually cheerful, he had fallen into a somber mood.
It ain't if you drown, P.I. observed.
There won't be much to cook when it gets dry, Poe said.
Newt and the Rainy boys had begun to talk of whores. Surely the captain would let them go to town with the rest of the crew when they hit Ogallala. The puzzling thing was how much a whore might cost. The talk around the wagon was never very specific on that score. The Rainy boys were constantly tallying up their wages and trying to calculate whether they would be sufficient. What made it complicated was that they had played cards for credit the whole way north. The older hands had done the same, and the debts were complicated. As the arrival in Ogallala began to dominate their thoughts almost entirely, the question of cash was constantly discussed, and many debts discounted on the promise of actual money.
"What if they don't pay us here?" the pessimistic Needle asked one night. "We signed on for Montana. We might not get no wages in Nebraska."
"Oh, the captain will pay us," Dish said.
Despite his attachment to Lorena, he was becoming as excited as the rest about going to town.
"Why would he?" Lippy asked. He don't care whether you have a whore or not, Dish."
That sentiment struck everyone as almost undoubtedly true, and established a general worry. By the time they crossed the stinking water, the worry had become so oppressive that many hands could think of nothing else. Finally, a delegation, headed by Jasper, approached Augustus on the subject. They surrounded him one morning when he came for breakfast and expressed their fear. Augustus had a big laugh when he figured out what was bothering them.
"Why, you girls," he said. "All you want is orgies."
"No, it's whores we want," Jasper said, a little irritated.
"It's fine for you to laugh. You got Lori." "Yes, but what's good for me ain't necessarily good for the weak-minded."
However, the next day he passed the word that everyone would be paid half wages in Ogallala. Call was not enthusiastic, but the men had worked well, and he couldn't oppose giving them a day in town. As soon as they heard the ruling, spirits improved, all except Pocampo's. He continued to insist that it would be dry.
Chapter 80.
When Elmira's fever finally broke, she was so weak she could barely turn her head on the pillow. The first thing she saw was Zwe, looking in the window of the doctor's little house. It was raining, but Zwe stood there in his buffalo coat, looking in at her. The next day he was still there, and the next. She wanted to call out to him to see if he had news of Dee, but she was too weak. Her voice was just a whisper. The doctor who tended her, a short man with a red beard, seemed not much healthier than she was. He coughed so hard that sometimes he would have to set her medicine down to keep from spilling it. His name was Patrick Arundel, and his hand shook after each coughing fit. But he had taken her in and tended her almost constantly for the first week, expecting all the time that she would die. "He's as loyal as any dog," he whispered to her, when she was well enough to understand conversation. For a while she had just stared back at him without comprehension when he spoke to her. He meant Zwe, of course. "I couldn't even get the man to go away and eat," the doctor told her. "I live on tea myself, but he's a big man. Tea won't keep him going. I guess he asked me 1,000 times if you were going to live." The doctor sat in a little thin-framed chair by her bed and gave her medicine by the spoonful. "It's to build you up," he said. "You didn't hardly have no blood in you when you got here." Elmira wished there was a window shade so she couldn't see Zwe staring at her. He stared for hours.
She could feel his eyes on her, but she was too weak to turn her head away. Luke seemed to be gone. At least he never showed up. "Where's Dee?" she whispered. When her voice came back a little. The doctor didn't hear. She said it so faint. But he happened to notice her lips move. She had to say it again. "Dee Boot," she whispered.
"Oh, did you follow that story?" the doctor said. "Hung him right on schedule about a week after they brought you in. Buried him in Boot Hill. It's a good joke on him, since his name was Boot. They killed a 9-year-old boy. He won't be missed around here."
Elmira shut her eyes, hoping she could be dead. From then on, she spat out her medicine, letting it dribble onto the gown the doctor had given her. He didn't understand at first.
"Sick to your stomach?" he said. "That's natural. We'll try soup." He tried soup, and she spat that out, too, for a day. But she was too weak to fight the doctor, who was almost as patient as Wei. They kept her jailed with their patience, when all she wanted to do was die. Dee was gone, after she had come such a way and found him. She hated Zwei and Luke for bringing her to the doctor. Surely she would have died right on the street if they hadn't. Last thing she wanted to do was get well and have to live. But days passed, and the doctor sat in a little chair feeding her soup, and Zwei stared in the window, even though she wouldn't look. Even not looking, she could smell Zwei. It was a hot summer, and the doctor left the window open all day. She could hear horses going by on the street and smell Zwei standing there only a few feet from her. Flies bothered her. The doctor asked if she wanted Zwei to come in, for he would be only too happy to sit and shoo the flies, but Elmira didn't answer. If Dee was dead, she was through with talk. It occurred to her one night that she could ask Zwei to shoot her. He would give her a gun, of course, but she didn't think she had the strength to pull the trigger. Better to ask him to shoot her. That would solve it, and they wouldn't do much to Zwei if he told them that he killed her at her own request. Just thinking of such a simple solution seemed to ease her mind a bit. She could have Zwei shoot her, and yet days passed, and she got so she could sit up in bed, and she didn't do it. Her mind kept going back to the spot of sunlight where Dee's face had vanished. His face had just faded into the sunlight. She couldn't stop thinking of it. In dreams, she would see it so clearly that she would wake up to the sound of Zwei snoring. He slept outside her window with his back to the wall of the house. His snores were so loud a person might have thought a bull was sleeping there. "What went with Luke?" she asked him one day.
"Went to Santa Fe," Zwei said.
It had been a month since she had spoken to him. He thought probably she never would again.
"Hired on with some traders. Come all this way and then headed back."
"I guess your child didn't live," the doctor said one day. "I wouldn't have expected it to, out on the prairie, with you having such a close call."
Elmira didn't answer. She remembered her breasts hurting, that was all. She had forgotten the child, the woman with the two daughters, the big house. Maybe the baby was dead. Then she remembered July and Arkansas, and a lot that she had forgotten. It was just as well forgotten. None of it mattered compared to Dee. It was all past, well past. Some day she would have Zwei shoot her, and she wouldn't have to think about things anymore. But she put it off, and in time got well enough to walk. She didn't go far, just to the door, to get a chamber pot or put one out of the room. The heat made the smells worse. Even Zwei had finally taken off his buffalo coat. He stood at the window in an old shirt with holes worn in it so that the thick hairs of his chest poked through. The doctor never asked her about money. Though she had gotten better, he hadn't. She could hear him coughing through the wall and sometimes saw him spit into a handkerchief. His hands trembled badly, and he always smelled of whiskey. It troubled her that he didn't ask her for money. She had always been one to pay her way. Finally, she mentioned it. She knew Zwei would go to work and get money for her if she asked him to. "You'll have to let me know what I owe," she said. But Patrick Arundel just shook his head.
"I came here to get away from money," he said. "Did it, too. Got away from it. It ain't easy to get away from money. Elmira didn't mention it again. If he wanted to be paid, he could mention it. She had tried. Then one day, with no warning from anyone, the door to her room opened and July walked in. Sway was standing at the window when it happened. July's face seemed thinner. "I found you, Ellie," he said. And there were tears in his eyes. Sway was watching, but because of the shadows, she didn't know if he could see that July was crying. Elmira looked away. She didn't know what to do. Mainly she regretted that she had not had Sway shoot her. Now July had found her. He had not come all the way in the room, but he was standing there, the door half open, waiting for her to ask him in. She didn't ask him in, didn't speak. It seemed she would always have bad luck if he could come all that way across the plains and still find her. Finally, July came in the room and closed the door. "The doctor says you're strong enough to talk," July said, wiping his eyes on his shirt sleeve. "You don't have to talk, though. You just lie there and get well. I won't stay very long. I just wanted you to know I came." Elmira looked at him once, then looked at the wall. "Well, you're a fool," she thought. "You ought not to have followed. You ought to just told folks I was dead." "I got a piece of bad news," July said. His eyes filled up again. "It's real bad, and it's my fault. Joe got killed. Him and Roscoe and a girl. An outlaw killed him. I ought to have stayed with him, but I don't know if it would have come out different if I had." "You wouldn't be here telling me anyway," Elmira thought. The news about Joe didn't touch her. She had never thought much about Joe. He had come when she had other things to worry about, and she had never gotten the habit of worrying about him. He gave her less trouble than July, though. At least he had sense enough to figure out she didn't want to be bothered with him, and had let her alone. If he was dead, that was that. She didn't remember him well. He hadn't talked much. He had just run out of luck on the plains. It might have happened to her, and she wished it had. "Ellie, the baby's fine," July said. "I didn't even know it was ours. That's the funny thing. I seen Clara holding it, and I had no notion it was ours. She named him Martin, if that's all right with you." "I guess we got our own family now," July added. His heart was sinking so that his voice almost failed, for Ellie had not turned her head or given much more than a momentary sign of recognition. She hadn't spoken. He wanted to think it was just her weakness, but he knew it was more than that. She wasn't happy that he had found her. She didn't care about the baby, didn't even care that Joe was dead. Her face had not changed expression since the first look of surprise. And all the while, the large man with the holes in his shirt stood at the window, silently looking in. He was one of the buffalo hunters, July supposed. The doctor had spoken well of the man, mentioning how loyal he was to Elmira, but July didn't understand why he was standing there, and his heart was sinking because Ellie wouldn't look at him. He had come such a way, too, but she wouldn't, and he didn't think it was just because she was sick. "We'll bring the baby in whenever you want it," July said. "I can rent a room till you're better. He's a strong baby. Clara says it won't hurt him a bit to come in. They've got a little wagon." Elmira waited. If she didn't talk, sooner or later he would leave. His voice was shaky. He sat down in the chair the doctor usually sat in by the bedside. After a moment, he took one of her hands. Sway was still looking in. July only held her hand for a moment. He dropped it and stood up. "I'll check every few days, Ellie," he said. "The doctor can send for me if you need me." He paused. In the face of her silence, he didn't know what to say. She sat propped up against the pillow, silent. It was almost as if she were dead. It reminded him of times in Arkansas, times in the loft when he felt as if he were with someone who wasn't there. When he had found out that she was alive and at the doctor's in Ogallala, he had gone off behind Clara's saddle shed and wept for an hour from relief. After all the worry and doubt, he had found her. But now, in a minute, the relief was gone, and he was reminded of all her difficulties, how nothing he did pleased her, not even finding her in Ogallala. He didn't know what more to do or say. She had married him and carried his child, and yet she wouldn't turn her head to look at him. Maybe it's too soon, he thought, as he stumbled, in a daze of pain and worry, out of the doctor's house. The big man was there watching. "How much obliged for all the help you've given Ellie," he said. "I'll pay you back for any expense." Zway said nothing. July walked away to get his horse. Ellie saw him ride past the window, and she got up and watched him until he was out of sight. Zway stood watching, too. "Zway," Elmira said, "get the wagon. I want to go." Zway was surprised. He had got used to her being in the bed in the doctor's house. He liked standing in the warm sun, watching her. She was so pretty in the bed.
"Ain't you sick?" he asked.
"No, get the wagon," she said. "I want to go today."
"Go which way?"
he asked. "Go," Elmira said. "Go away from here. I don't care where. Over to St. Louis will do."
"I don't know the way to St. Louis," Sway said.
"Oh, get the wagon. We'll find the way," she said. "There's a road, I guess." She was out of patience with men. They were great ones for asking questions. Even Zway asked them, and he could barely talk. Zway did as he was told. The doctor was gone, treating a farmer who had broken his hip. Elmira thought about leaving him a note, but didn't. The doctor was smart. He would figure out soon enough that she was gone. And before the sun set, they left Ogallala, going east. Elmira rode in the wagon on the buffalo skin. Zway drove. His horse was hitched to the rear of the wagon. She had asked him to take her, which made him proud. Luke had tried to confuse him, but now Luke was gone, and the man who came to see Elmira had been left behind. She had asked him to take her, not the other man. It must mean that they were married, just as he had hoped. She didn't say much to him, but she had asked him to take her, and that knowledge made him feel happy. He would take her anywhere she asked. The only troublesome thought he had was the result of something the man at the livery stable said. He had been a dried-up little fellow, smaller than Luke. He had asked which way they were going, and Zway pointed east. He knew St. Louis was east. "You might as well leave your scalps, then," the man said. "Have 'em sent by mail once you get there." "Why?" Zway asked, puzzled. He had never heard of anyone sending a scalp in the mail. "Because of the Sioux," the man said.
"We never saw no Indians the whole way from Texas," Zway remarked.
"You might not see the Sioux either," the man said. "But they'll see you. You're a damn fool to take a woman east of here." Zway mentioned it to Elmira while he was helping her into the wagon.
"There might be Indians that way," he said.
"I don't care," Elmira said. "Let's go." Many nights on the trail from Texas she had lain awake in terror of Indians. They saw none, but the fear stayed with her all the way to Nebraska. She had heard too many stories. Now she didn't care. The sickness had changed her, that and the death of Dee. She had lost the fear. A few miles from town they stopped and camped. She lay awake in the wagon much of the night. Zway slept on the ground, snoring, his rifle held tightly in his big hands. She wasn't sleepy, but she wasn't afraid either. It was cloudy, and the plains were very dark. Anything could come out of the darkness. Indians, bandits, snakes. The doctor had claimed there were panthers. All she heard was the wind rustling the grass. Her only worry was that July might follow. He had followed all the way from Texas. He might follow again. Maybe Zway would kill him if he followed. It was peculiar that she disliked July so, but she did. If he didn't leave her alone, she would have Zwei kill him. Zwei woke early. The man at the livery stable had worried him. He had been in three